Hello, everybody. This is Stu Smith, and we're doing another Tactical Fitness Report. And I have a special guest, Steve Smith, which a lot of people get us confused because I can't tell you how many times Jeff Nichols, I met you through Jeff Nichols. Jeff Nichols says, yeah, if you want stuff on nutrition, go talk to Steve Smith, right? And people say, oh, okay. And they, some reason they type Stu Smith in there, and it comes in as a no, I'm not Steve Smith. Go to here. Right. So I've been referring people to you that were somehow found me by Jeff referring them to you. And so it's a big circle. So I wanted to put a name with the face with the name and share a little bit about what you do. But Steve has a great history. He's a dietitian. He's also a chef. So he makes his healthy food taste good, which is probably a pretty valuable combination. That's why he has worked for the Houston Texans, you know, in professional sports. He has worked for Army Special Operations Command, and he has his own practice there in Texas, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. But thank you for coming on, Steve. I appreciate
Thanks for having me. Really
I appreciate your time in this. So what we're going to talk about today is, you know, some of the challenges the tactical athlete has with just fueling themselves for maybe we can kind of go into the phases of tactical fitness. So you got the recruit who's trying to prepare for fitness tests. You have the candidate who is trying to prepare for selection or going through selection, you know, some of the strategies there. And then you have the active duty guy, that is just trying to maintain stay put together and healthy and, you know, mitigate stress and everything like that. So would love to kind of pick your brain on maybe talk a little bit about the generic fueling strategies for those type of people, but then maybe talk a little bit about the importance of individualization and personalized nutrition planning that you do professionally as well, that, you know, there in Texas. So, you know, let's just start it off with, you know, the recruit who is preparing by doing long workouts and trying to focus on scoring really well on these fitness tests. And a lot of these fitness tests are pretty challenging nowadays, especially on the special ops side when you're focusing on a fast 500-yard swim and pull-ups and push-ups and sit-ups and a mile-and-a-half run. You know, now the Army has the combat fitness test, which measures a lot more elements of fitness, you know, from strength and power, speed and agility, muscle stamina, cardiovascular endurance. Yeah, there's so many different, you know, it's pretty much, you know, the tactical athlete has to be good at all of those elements of fitness. You know, unlike your, you know, Houston Texans, who are, you know, remarkably great at just a few of those elements of fitness to be able to do their job on the football field, you know, there are elements of fitness that the pro athlete doesn't need to concern themselves with, whereas the tactical athlete needs to concern themselves with all of them. They just don't need to be great at any of them. They just need to be really good, proficient. And depending on your level of, I guess, activity in your job, whether it's regular military, special ops, special groups, you know, special programs that are out there,
right,
might require a higher level of fitness and strength variety.
Yeah, and a lot of it really is up to what your primary job set is. You know, once you, when you go in, I mean, the recruit is the recruit. You have to go in and meet the minimum standards. And, you know, if you're trying to get selected into a pipeline to be able to go to special operations, you're going to have to score better than your peers. So, the test has changed considerably, which I think by and large is a huge positive overall, because it prevents you from being able to come in cold and be able to, you know, max out a fitness test without having much training in the background. It demands that you train consistently and in a relatively balanced way. You can't leave any big, I guess, big ticket item off to the wayside and be able to do well in your testing.
Right. I think the new tests, which I really enjoy, but, you know, the selection programs always will find those weaknesses, you know.
It's your job.
I think the new fitness tests are at least getting people to observe their weaknesses early and address those along their preparation phases before they get into the selection programs, where I promise you they will be exposed in about 2 days.
Whenever you're in
the selections program. So let's maybe talk a little bit about that. I know game day performance, like when we talk about game day performance, nutrition and fueling for that is really critical, as far as, especially performing optimally on these fitness tests, because sometimes you have one chance to pass this test, or your career takes a left or a right-hand turn.
Especially officer versus enlisted, depending on the pipeline you're going. Officers right. have one shot go. Enlisted, you may, if you're lucky and you check all the boxes, get a second shot, but that's even few and far between these days. So.
Right. So, game day matters, and fueling matters, during your preparation, you should be practicing, the types of fueling strategies that work for you. And that's what I bring Steve on here to really get into the depths of that. But one thing I have always done is always kept notes. When I had a kick butt day, I was hitting some PRs. I didn't really say, hey, that's pretty good. I must have been training perfectly for that. I look back at the last 24 hours on everything I did. How did I sleep? What did I eat? How did I hydrate? All of those little things matter, in those 24 hours. And if you do that right, you can find a great little formula that works for you, for that, for bringing in that game day performance when you need it. So,
yeah. And I think one of the pieces that's come to light, we see it on ESPN a little bit more with kind of like their version of what they call load management. It's really just an awareness of what your demands are as an athlete and how that matches up with your recovery and the big picture of what game day is actually going to look like. And are you prepared for that game day, or are you overtrained, undertrained? Like, what is your big picture? And I think that's, it's good that that's being brought to light. I think one of the places where it still has a lot of room to grow, I think, is moving into the pipeline as a recruit. A lot of times when you're put in a position of where you have structure around you, you're taught to be able to track some of these pieces, or at least have a potential mentor that can guide you a little bit. But coming in, you're relying on friends or connections somehow. And if you allow yourself to become a virtual expert on yourself, understanding, what led to the performance and what are your, what are kind of the holes that you're looking to fill, you need to be able to make an informed decision, because you don't have forever to get to that point where you get in. And if everything comes down to that performance, that one shot go, you want to put yourself in the best position possible to perform adequately, and really having that information on the back end will give you the best possible way to be able to say, hey, I need to do this leading up to it, or this worked well for me in the past when I did some, let's say, test versions of the actual day test. And some areas where you're like, oh crap, I really need to fix that. It really showed up and I need to get ahead of that, or find a new strategy to be able to get on top of my, whether it be nutrition, make sure I get adequate rest, manage the stress ahead of time so that you can perform on that day. One of the things that's missed across the board, I would say in sport and the tactical side, it would be a lot of it becoming aware of how your body reacts to the different states of training, stress, nutrition, et cetera. And I think the better job that you do in the process, not only doing the training effectively and safely and matching that with appropriate nutrition, but also tracking that, the yes. better off you're going to be long-term.
Yes, 100%. I agree. That's why, keeping a journal of your training and nutrition side by side has been, a huge change in performance maintenance for me. And, whenever I am doing some form of progression, it forces me to be a little more logical in my progressions, because I don't just go from, 10 miles a week to 30 miles a week you know, if I'm doing an endurance cycle.
Not without a quick check in and say, hey, dumbass, what are you doing?
Right, exactly. I was like, what is this?
And part of it too, when you have to write it down, it holds you accountable on your own. Like you're holding yourself accountable to you, not necessarily to somebody else doing that. But that also changes the, you know, am I really going to make this decision? Is this what's in my best interest? I'm writing it down. It gives you another set of checks and balances to be able to put yourself, have the opportunity to redirect or put you in a position of advantage, regardless whether it's training, nutrition, sleep, et cetera.
Yeah, you said a really good point there, you know, finding some of the leaks. You know, I think, you know, that allowed me personally to find a couple of leaks that I had. You know, I was just trying to lose some weight, you know, off a heavy weightlifting cycle, got a little big, got a little strong, got stronger, but got a little too big for wanting me personally. So I wanted to drop down again. And so looking back at my charts, I was like, oh, this little spoonful of peanut butter 3 times a day is really affecting my total calorie. That stuff's like 500. No wonder I'm not losing weight. I got 500 extra calories every day. And sure enough, just took out those 3 spoonfuls of peanut butter and started dropping.
There's a lot of pitfalls. And if you don't have an awareness of what's going in, I mean, a lot of times the nutrition piece, I get this all the time. I'm like, God, I'm in a deficit. I don't know why I'm losing, why I'm not losing. I'm like, well, by definition, you're not in a deficit. I can tell you that very simply, no matter how much you want to argue, you might not like that fact. One way or another, whether it's through physiological adaptation or whether it's from fork to mouth,
yeah,
there's some sort of imbalance from an energy standpoint that's preventing you from being able to lose. And our body's a pretty amazing machine. It'll find a way to keep you from doing dumb things to yourself. But
that is true.
As a part of it, we just have to be able to be aware. So that with that awareness, we have the ability to make that decision.
So I imagine as a dietitian, you get a lot of different types of requests from weight gain programs, weight loss programs, you know, performance oriented programming, you know, diabetics on one side, you know, health, you know, people on the health, you know, spectrum. Where is it that you find the most, I guess the most common in nutrition requests, you know, as a dietitian, where in your world, where you work, that I was just curious, you know, what is the most common, you know, factor, you know, what are your macros, you know, you know,
so. I think the top two kind of, I guess, big areas or big questions, if you want to call it that. The number one is, what the hell do I eat? Like, I feel like I'm doing well, but I honestly have no idea. I've been following this, but I don't, whatever this may be, whether it's somebody's advice, whether they got online, a friend, et cetera. Or they were an athlete in the past and they just applied what they did before, just maybe increasing or decreasing depending on the activity. Or like, I want to lean out and be the most efficient I can be whenever I get to said training iteration, whether it be selection, whether it be the recruiting pipeline, whatever the case may be. So whether it be federal law enforcement, whether it be in the, you know, special operations world, or just getting into let's say a general active lifestyle. Most people by and large will ask to have some sort of leanness component to their program. Even if they're gaining weight, they still want to quote unquote lean out.
Sure.
So that's always a component of it. And when I ask for what they're doing, a lot of times the response is, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, well, all right. Yeah. Thanks.
So yeah, exactly. So, I guess designing programs for them to do, you know, has to take into account one, foods that they like, but also getting rid of foods that aren't good for them that they may like, and adding in some new foods that they might like as well. So it's kind of a gamble as a nutrition dietitian to insert new foods for people. How is that? How have you found people to best evolve into that? Because these are new habits that you're trying to create, which are so challenging, whether it's a fitness habit or it's a nutrition habit. They're hard habits.
Behavior change is one of the hardest things for people to execute ultimately, because it takes work and it takes consistent work
and discipline.
It's not a get through your workout and you're done. This is a like concerted effort you think about the number of times that you eat in a day, we just kind of passively do it as a regular daily activity. And if you're not paying attention to it, or at least you don't have some sort of understanding or structure ahead of time to guide you, you can go off track pretty easily, one way or the other.
Very easily.
Yeah, I ask a ton of questions. In fact, I probably, when my clients see the amount of questionnaires that they get when they sign up, the initial reactions, probably if I could see their face, like, what the shit is this? Are you kidding me? Why are we asking this? But a lot of it is, if you don't understand how you got to where you are today, or if I don't understand that, then I've got a whole lot of variables that I can't account for. And so therefore I'm either doing you a disservice by not accounting for some of those pieces you may not know, take part in evaluating what the best first step is, or we just may be missing a big ticket item of like your daily life from a work standpoint. Because most people coming into the military aren't just coming in cold. If you're a recruit, there are many that have families. There are many that are either current athletes or former athletes that are trying to work to be able to pay bills before they get in. You're not just training for the most part. There are a few people that are, but there's life that has to happen. And that's a piece that people don't account for. A lot of the jobs that are done are also manual labor. And if you don't expect that to account for some increased energy,
sure,
then you're kidding yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, it's a big one. I think the hard part for people to grasp is, you know, your previous eating pattern can potentially dictate how you're going to respond to what I give you. Like, for example, some of these people that have done severe restriction in the past. When I say that, like a keto diet, for example, I hate to bring that up because it's kind of one of those like four letter words these days, literally and figuratively. But
well, you know, you're talking about eliminating a macronutrient, pretty much.
And what people don't recognize is that if you don't return to a quote unquote normal eating pattern, or relatively normal eating pattern, reintroducing carbohydrates in a specific way, you're going to have what we call a carbohydrate rebound. So you're going to have a huge weight and fluid shift.
Huh?
Like, why the hell am I gaining weight? I'm eating less than I was before. Well, there's this wonderful endocrinology world that deals with the insulin shift, and it's a disproportionate increase, basically saying your body's kind of freaking out momentarily. It's not used to having it. And so the reason why a lot of the history is taken is because that's going to directly impact what your next step is going to be. So a lot of people generally restrict in some way, shape, or form, or feel like they need to. I think that's another piece of a lot of people like, oh, I got to get rid of this. I got to get rid of this. Got to get rid of this. But we live in a world of the pendulum swing. You know, from I eat everything to I eat nothing to I eat everything to I eat nothing. And really at the end of the day, you're going to end up sitting here. You're not going to make improvement because that pendulum swing coming back up is going to put you right back in that position if you're trying to lose. And potentially restricting is going to get in the way of performance in some ways.
Sure.
To me, it's about creating a sustainable long-term model. There may be some adjustments based on what your short-term goals are, whether it be leanness, there's an absolute weight that you have to get to be able to meet standards or to be able to complete a run comfortably. Yeah. But at the end of the day, if you do it in a sustainable way, not in an extreme restriction way, you can actually come out of that in a much better position to be able to transition to the next set of training and to the next set of whatever your priorities are. So we have kind of the stages we talked about in the past of getting to and then through,
sure,
of being the most resilient, prepared athlete that you can possibly be. And then when the time comes, once you've gotten to that selection period, potentially if we want to use that example, then it's how do we get through that, continue to be able to get to a point where now we have to worry about the sustainment.
Right. Let's kind of break that down a little bit. Because you know, as a recruit goes through their journey, and let's say they get accepted by crushing a PST and they're in the program. But you know, there's these incremental maintenance PSTs that you will have to take throughout your journey as well. Is there a particular type of fueling strategy that you would recommend on game day of we'll go generic here, any type of standard fitness test that people have to take?
So I guess the biggest rule of thumb that I try to impart to everybody that's doing, whether they're my client or not, is don't try something new on game day. It's the same thing that you say to your athletes. The quickest way to end your race, let's say in a marathon world, is to put something new in, you're going to be run to the crapper.
Yep.
Real quick. Yes. So if you throw something new in, you haven't trained with it in your stomach, why the hell are you putting it in there when you're adding the highest stress event that you possibly could have? That's going to alter the way that you tolerate that food anyway. So don't stack the deck against yourself, number one. Yeah. It's about making sure that during the training process leading up to that, you've actually trained with food in your body during training, you can tolerate and you know what will work and what won't.
Yeah.
Being able to have a few things that are readily available across the board, dry, let's say shelf stable, is a huge advantage, because if you're out and you happen to be doing this test when it's super hot, you can't expect something to be cold. And if you're only used to grabbing something out of the fridge and tolerating it that way, you're not used to something lukewarm or hot. Mm. And that's just another kind of, that may be less of an issue.
That's a good point though.
Spoils.
Yeah.
Then you don't have that as an option.
Right. Yeah. You can't be carrying around milk with you, you
know, right,
in the heat of the day.
Which wouldn't be a bad thing, but you know, I'm definitely not going to use it as a recommendation.
Yeah. I'm not drinking milk before a test.
No shot. I don't feel like having, you know, it's like shaking baby. You wonder why a kid pukes after you bounce them around the same reason you drink that and then you go run.
Right. And, you know, that's a real good point, because, you know, a lot of people, you know, can get cramps just from food bouncing in their stomach or water, you know, if they overhydrated before a test and now they're running. You know, I always recommend people to, you know, if you're going to take one of these tests that's requiring your maximum effort and you're just about failing, you know, before you actually reach muscle failure, you're stopping, you know, as a part of our strategy, but you're pushing yourself right to that level. You're burning a lot of glycogen in your body, right? You are just blood sugar and glycogen, you know, whatever you got there, it's going, you know. Eventually you might even create this little lightheadedness feeling, you know, in your body right before you get to the run. And now it's a fast run, even though it's a mile and a half considered, you know, some people consider that long distance. You can't necessarily rely on aerobic activity to get you to where you want to be, depending on your training. I mean, if you're
in a position of high stress, if you think about that, your heart rate's going to be artificially elevated because you're put in a position of stress.
True.
And so that just challenges the system one more kind of notch up. So you've already got, for lack of a better way to put it, the deck stacked against you. So it's about having that fuel available during that training session. So much like you talked about, you know, training with food in you, you know, having some sort of, you know, nutritive beverage or food stuff while you're doing the test in between phases, whatever you can carry with you, is of huge benefit. Are you going to be able to use it right away? No, depending on what it is, but you have the potential advantage of being able to. So there's some really good information out there. We actually used to use this in a lot of sports settings. So you could even swish a sports drink in your mouth,
sure,
without even swallowing it, and provide your body basically access to a greater amount of energy internally. You're allowing your body to mobilize the energy and basically free it up. It's expecting more to come into those stores, and so it frees up what you have available there. And so you can actually play the game a little bit there. If you can't tolerate putting something in, even doing a carbohydrate mouth rinse is an advantage to be able to provide readily available energy to the working muscle tissue if you just absolutely can't tolerate something.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I used to do bubble gum. Yeah. The same thing, I mean, but it had to be sugar bubble gum, like Juicy Fruit or something like that. It was just pure sugar.
Yeah, I mean, similar. You know, think about the receptors. That's where you're activating in the mouth itself. Right. And so, if you're able to provide that stimulus, whether it's through gum, whether it's through let's say Gatorade, Powerade, an ORS, because there's little or no carbohydrate in that.
Right.
Some sort of carbohydrate stimulation, you get the same effect. It's great.
Yeah, you know, during the test, that has always been my go-to. Some kind of liquid carbohydrate drink. I personally like red Gatorade.
Everybody's got their one flavor. Trust
you
me.
Know, I that's what I like. You know, I will drink. I'll drink other colors, but just like the red one, and then a piece of gum. You know, just because one, you know, sometimes it's, you know, it's dry out or it's humid. Sometimes the extra, you know, saliva in there, you know, keeps you from mouth drying out and things like that. So, but anyway, I have found that to be very helpful. But before the test, let's think about timing before the test.
So this is where it's really up to the individual, right? So the night before, there's no benefit to going through and doing what a lot of people in the old school version would say of like carbohydrate loading, like go and have your massive pasta dinner the night before. You're right. Just going to create massive crabs. Like you're just not going to feel well.
Yeah.
So it's eating a normal dinner with maybe slightly a little bit more carbohydrate, but you don't need to double and triple the volume of carbohydrate that you're going to have. You've assuming that you're adequately nourished. When I say adequately nourished, you have enough energy normally, like throughout your training process, you haven't been in a deficit the whole time.
Right.
And basically low energy availability during your training, you've been at least even towards the end of your training leading up to it. And then the morning of, depending on what your tolerance is, this is one of those that's very, very individualized. If you haven't been able to find something that you can tolerate close to training, then it's trying to back your first meal a couple hours away from training itself. And then as you get closer and closer to training, it's going to progressively get to easier digested sources of energy. So you go from whole food sources, whatever that may be for your carbohydrate for breakfast, can't talk today.
Yeah.
The whole way up to the start of your actual test, which could be a liquid form.
Sure.
In small amounts. We're not talking drinking an entire 20-ounce Gatorade.
No.
We're talking a few ounces here and there. Sipping, this is not something I think when we mention a lot of this stuff, people take things automatically to the extreme. If I have it, I have to have a lot of it. More is not better in this case. And so it's about progressively getting to a point where you're not pushing your stomach and your GI tract beyond the limit, but you're kind of honoring, knowing like this is going to cause me a problem. Don't do dumb shit.
Right.
Like if you know it causes you a problem, don't do it. Because you're going to cause yourself worse problems than being under fueled if you have to go run back and forth.
Yeah, that's a good point. I've always taken the PST, you know, the fitness test for, you know, spec ops level candidates as not only a physical performance, it is actually an eating competition as well.
Oh yeah.
You know
especially
what I mean?
During selection.
Yeah, but yeah, before, during, yes, absolutely.
During selection is an absolute nightmare for a lot of people to eat because you are so exhausted, you're so stressed, you're on as every waking hour, you are 100% on, otherwise you're missing something.
Yeah.
And so that much kind of input overloads you and your hunger and fullness is virtually gone.
And yeah, so you're eating 5,000-6,000 calories just to maintain weight, you know.
Yeah. I mean, we had a not so funny joke at the Ranger rebound. You know, when you come out of Ranger school, you got guys that are, they look like skeletons when they come out because they've been not necessarily underfed, but you know, they're out for 3 months doing whatever they're doing. And then they come back and they go down the road and have their massive shake and burgers. And all of a sudden you got the 15, 20 pound push, but the same thing during selection, it's about how can you prioritize getting the energy that you need to recover from the training session that you just did and prepare for the next one that they're going to likely, you know, you're not only are you having to eat to get all that energy in, how big is your window to eat?
Yeah.
Right. The ways to induce stress is to speed things up, lose sleep, and put you in an uncomfortable position. All right. And you can enhance the discomfort by limiting energy and limiting sleep.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah. No kidding. Like Ranger school is, you know, I was so glad to see when I was going through Buds was that we, you know, especially during Hell Week, you know, when it's 120 straight hours, but we were eating every 6 hours.
Yeah, there's no want for food during BUDS.
No.
Really in the higher level training iterations and selections, there is no lack of energy because the goal is not to deprive you of energy. The goal is to be able to evaluate how well you tolerate stress, and whether it be implement movement, team drills, whether it be just physical fitness tests and stress inoculation, they want to be able to evaluate you evenly across the board, and they don't want to necessarily remove the energy because then that's not you.
Right.
Right. And that actually, it limits the candidate pool without even having to test you.
Sure. I mean, a lot of bad things happen when you lose the fuel because you mix that in with hydration as well. Now you're talking about heat casualties, talking about you're bonking way too early. You know, you can't even finish a test because, you're throwing up and you're dizzy and it looked like you just had a diabetic fit because you just have no glycogen in your body.
You've got guys with altered mental status because of that. As part of it, because their electrolyte balance goes off, and for any number of reasons with the bigger situation, that's more than just one piece there, obviously. But the goal is not to deprive you of energy there. But a lot of people don't necessarily recognize that you're going to have to be able to put down a good quantity of food in a relatively short period of time and then tolerate getting your butt up and moving again. That's kind of the secondary piece is, if you can't train the food in your stomach, you're going to be a quick out.
Yeah, you got to learn how to eat and go for a run.
And keep it down.
It kind of sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And part of it too may be, all right, I know this is going to cause me problems, but I know I can tolerate this, this, and this. It's coming up with, you've got, just like mission plan, you've got best case scenario. This is our first set, but here are the 10 oh shit plans. If this can't happen, or I can't tolerate it, just can't physically get it in, what are my next options? That, the standard is still the standard and it's completing everything, but it may look a little bit different from your ideal.
Right. Yeah. Like your meal may not agree with you, but your snacks have to.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So
you have to find a way to get to neutral.
Yes. Yeah.
You're not going to be above.
Yeah, one thing I tell people all the time, one thing that got me through BUDS was carrot sticks and apple slices. And I ate those all the time, like in between events. I always had a Ziploc bag in my cargo pocket full of apple slices and carrots and honey packets.
Oh, yeah. Those things are gold.
Oh, man.
Might as well be currency over there.
They really are. I mean, honey packets, oh, that's pure sugar if you're going anaerobic, it's helpful.
That's a bit of morale. Like you feel like everything in the world sucks and the whole world is crashing down. You have that, you have hope.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. Very good point. So let's talk a little bit about the energy system. So we have the phosphocreatine energy system, which we call the high performance zone that, if you're a football player, you're going to be really involved with this energy system for five, 10 seconds of all out go, whether that's sprinting or it's lifting or whatever. But now, some of the fitness tests do require that, when you're talking about deadlifts, some of the sprints, some of the shuttle runs that are out there, some of the throws, the power throws, that are all.
Yeah, and I think one of the pieces that's really unique about the changeup of the test is that it's forcing you to be a relative athlete in some way, shape, or form. Like it's more than just a probably a bad way to put it, more than just a safety test.
Yeah.
It's an actual test for athletic proficiency in some way. And I think it's actually going to lead to, from a physical standpoint, maybe not mental or execution wise, but it may lead to better competition and better pools whenever you get beyond that initial recruit phase. I think that would
probably be ideal. I think it helps.
Everybody has this standard now.
Absolutely. I think it builds a better foundation to build all your job requirements and skills that you need to build on top of that. Because there's going to be load bearing, there's going to be lifting artillery shells and running ammo back and forth and running for a quick sprint to duck for cover. I mean, there's going to be some requirements that are going to be very similar to these new tests.
And as a part of the test, I mean, there is going to be some component, even at the baseline level, of being able to tolerate some shittiness. Like, there's going to get to a point where you have to tolerate some suck and really either embrace it or not. And the results are going to kind of go based on your ability or willingness to, because you're not going to be able to match all your demands real time from an energy system standpoint. It just doesn't happen realistically. And that's where you get some of the, you know, the side effects of the serious burn, the feeling like you're about to bonk, all these pieces. It's challenging your tolerance for some of that pH change in the muscle from the amount that you're burning through and the byproducts of that contraction. And how well can you get to a point where you can take advantage of these like micro rest points? Can you get to a point where you can breathe, you can, you know, effectively oxygenate and drop your heart rate, take advantage and be able to bring yourself to a position where you can replenish the ATP stores within those, you know, those areas that are just absolutely spent? And can you rely a little bit in those times of at least a little bit less stress or activity on more of an aerobic balance? So you're using all of the system simultaneously in different amounts. So the goal there would be, can you get to a point where you can actually actively change your state of energy use? And that can be done in several different ways. Could be done in pacing, could be done with breathing, could be done with a lot of different things. Obviously training has a big part in it.
Sure.
But then also feeding as well, right? So all these pieces kind of play together, and it's a goal of how can you take advantage of the little spots when you have them, let's say whether it be planning or just being able to get through it, to be able to put yourself in a position of advantage. Because if you're relying purely on that alactic energy system the entire time, you're up a creek without a paddle. You just cannot physically rely on that. It just, the math doesn't work.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. It's impossible. And they all, I realize they all blend in together when you're talking about the phosphocreatine and you're talking about anaerobic, aerobic activity, you know, glycolytic and, you know, your fat burning phases. You know, I've always said, if you can get your conditioning so good that you never have to go anaerobic to doing what you're doing, which it's almost impossible to do. But if you can do that, you know, and run your mile and a half and be in a aerobic state, that's impressive. But you've done something that not a lot of people can do, you know, especially when they're competing. You know, for instance, the marathon runners that are doing, you know, sub 5 minute miles for 26 miles.
Yeah, they get crushed under a rock.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
It's a great equalizer, right?
There is a great equalizer, or a pull-up bar, right? Sure. That's always a tough one too. But anyway, let's just talk a little bit about those energy systems that we mentioned and, you know, why all three macronutrients are important in those.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think people they attach too specifically to kind of the opposite ends of the spectrum, right? The reason why people are so fascinated by things involving fat and at least the connotation of keto is that they believe that they're becoming more aerobically centered in burning. Not wholesale true. But we're not going to go down that rabbit hole for fear of never coming back.
Right.
But then a lot of people attach the, you know, high power output, short durations with carbohydrates. Absolutely. And I think those, to a certain extent, are true. I think the balance ultimately becomes, you know, protein is, if you're using protein as a primary energy source, you're in a bad place.
Yeah.
It's an extremely inefficient energy source in and of itself. It's not a position you want to put your body in. You would ideally be able to provide an adequate amount of energy to spare the protein for use in repair and regeneration, its primary focus.
Right.
So that would be the real big reason why, you know, protein can stay relatively constant. It can stay as that kind of guiding light, for lack of a better way to put it. And then based on training, the rest of your energy need, whether it be higher or lower, can be altered based on fat and carbohydrate intake. The fat intake, the one piece that you have to be really careful of is a lot of people try to go towards the traditional, like, lower fat type feeding styles whenever you're trying to manage weight. And you have to be careful not going too low, right? Fat has its purpose in your ability to function, your ability to be able to have appropriate hormone levels, to be able to allow you to utilize fat-soluble vitamins. And so if you remove too much, you actually get in your own way.
Yeah, sure.
And so it's keeping that even balance there, and then making sure that we're able to periodize that carbohydrate. So that's why I say, you know, as you lead up to some of the training, and then even during the training, using carbohydrate to be able to help replenish what you can't physically just turn over without putting anything back in. It's using that in a competition setting in a quote unquote periodized fashion, basically between your sets or between your events, to be able to help. And again, it's not chugging a 20 ounce Gatorade between. It's having a few ounces here and there. It's making sure that you, whatever you put in, you can tolerate, and you can put in enough to be able to meet your needs. You don't need to put in 700 or 800 calories in real-time fuel to get through a fitness test.
No, yeah.
You're not burning that much.
Right.
In reality.
Yeah, that's
a good
point.
It may feel like it, but the reality is you're not actually going through that much energy. Sure. It's just challenging everything a bit to the limit, to where you have to be able to have that developed energy system to replenish fast enough to continue.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point, because, you know, all of this really comes down to, yes, you need the fuel to train, and you need the training to hit, you know, those certain levels that, you know, require the different fueling strategies, right? Because yeah. You can't necessarily.
It's almost like the exercise side of, like, we don't want to go volume for the sake of volume, because then you're just going to beat somebody to shit. The same way from a nutrition standpoint, if you go volume for the sake of volume, because I'm burning this energy, so I need to just push it and push it, well, then that's where you get people where, when you weigh in and weigh out from a hydration standpoint, guys have gained 2 or 3 pounds after a short, relatively low intensity exercise.
Right.
That's actually not a benefit.
Right.
And in some cases, depending on how that weight was gained, it can potentially be a problem. Yeah. So it's managing what you have. You don't need to push one way or the other. It's getting to know what you require and how your body responds through the training process leading up to that event, so that when the day comes, there's no question. Your plan is in place, execute it and go.
Yeah, that's a good point. When you're over, the volume of food or hydration that you're bringing in prior to a test, you will likely see that again if that volume is too high.
Yeah, if you think about it, there's a lot of things that play into the way that your GI tract, the way that you perceive the feeling there, right? So the joy of eating, its intent is primarily, besides energy, is to create neurotransmitters. The problem is it talks back. Right. So stress, fear, anger, whatever it may be, whatever you want to call those damn things upstairs, the first place you're going to feel them, we call somatization, is going to be in the GI tract. So high stress environments or in areas that, whether you perceive it as stress, like you're freaked out momentarily, whatever you want to call that, or whether it's just passively happening and you're just overloaded, it can show up as nausea, it can show up as diarrhea, some of these other things. So it's managing those high stress times too. And if you haven't been put in that position, then there's a whole lot of wrenches that can be thrown in.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It definitely comes with your preparation. You should be taking a lot of these practice tests. So the anxiety.
Part of the training process is to train your gut.
Absolutely. Yes. Practice test is, you not only are you practicing the anxiety that is involved in taking these tests, and you can help reduce that, but you're also practicing your fueling strategies so you can perform at your best, and you keep notes of those fueling strategies and what works. So let's real quick, let's talk a little bit about the macronutrients. You know, what are your gold standards for carbohydrates, in these type of situations? I'm going to ask you to go, like, what are your favorites? Just your favorites personally. It doesn't have to be, anything other than what you like to eat.
So my favorites personally, because I know in high stress environments, I want to try to provide myself the best opportunity to not jack my stomach up. So a lot of times it's stuff like, you know, for my carbohydrate, whether it's by itself or with protein, et cetera, it's going to be like a white rice that's maybe cooked a little bit more than I normally would. Breaking things down a little bit, having some plain toast. I'm not adding a ton of, when I say a ton, I'm not adding big boluses of fat to sit like a rock. I'm putting in enough to be able to make it palatable. So it's not like eating cardboard, but I'm not putting in more than what I can tolerate at that point. So I'd say I generally rely on, whether it be, you know, a lot of people talk about steel cut oats. I'd rather not have as much fiber.
Yeah.
Free. So if I can go with a white rice instead of a brown rice, or I can do like a little bit overcooked rolled oats like that, that's a good, solid, tolerable carbohydrate source itself. Some people rely on things like banana, applesauce, toast, things like that, because there's not a – I generally stay away from spices and heat around there. You're adding just another one of those wrenches to potentially, you know, you never know what the trigger is going to be. And I want to eliminate as many of the potential issues that could possibly come up. And then as far as protein is concerned, it's really what I'm going to put enough in to be able to have fullness at a comfortable level, but not, I don't want to be over full, right? Because if you're over full, you just feel like crap. You're not going to feel like you're going to move. So, you know, 3-4 eggs, you know, some white rice or some oatmeal, some toast, some water. I'm good to go. I'm not a heavy salt sweater, so I usually don't use an ORS unless I'm out. Like if I was out doing a longer ruck and, you know, long sleeves and you're all kitted up, you're going to need a little bit more. But most of the time it's just getting some fluid in to be able to keep things moving, stay adequately hydrated. You don't need to drink 2 16-ounce bottles of water. You just need to continually drink.
Sure.
If you put in large amounts quickly, it will come out quickly.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So it's about that kind of consistent flow overall. But yeah, so that would be my biggest focus from a carbohydrate standpoint is something I can tolerate. It's not going
to
mess me up.
All right. Now, how about this? How about throughout your whole day? Doesn't have to be pre-test or anything. Just carbohydrates that you enjoy throughout the whole day.
I'd say a lot of times, probably out of convenience more than anything else, I can stick a crap ton of sweet potatoes in the oven and get them done as times everybody's nightmare, no matter how busy you are or not. I prefer to do kind of larger batches that way. Whether it be rice, sweet potatoes, white potatoes, you name it. Occasionally I'll throw some bread in there if I'm super lazy and I just have it around. I don't feel like cooking. Like, yeah, I'm hitting my numbers. I'm not causing myself a problem. A lot of times in those instances, I'm just like, I know I need to have it and I just don't feel like anything else.
Right.
I'll throw that in there. For me, it's about the balance throughout the day and making sure, you know, my primary focus is making sure I have enough protein consistently throughout the day in frequent feedings. And the carbohydrate to match whatever I'm doing for exercise. So if I'm not doing shit that day, if I'm sitting in my office, I'm not going to have quite as much as I would if I'm going out and doing a freaking hypertrophy workout.
Exactly.
Or if I'm going to do a long run, or if I'm going to do interval training.
Yep.
Like all of those things demand a different energy amount. And I guess the caveat to that is if you're in, let's say, a hypertrophy phase, even your off days, there's a bit of a carryover effect where take advantage of that increase. And I wouldn't go lower necessarily on those other days. I would just stay even to allow my body to get back to neutral because I'm asking so much of it during that training phase that I want to give it the opportunity to recover fully before I go kick its ass again the next day.
Right. I tend to like a variety of carbs. I mainly I will say this, I get most of my carbs from fruits and vegetables. So like my salads are.
Same, but I was thinking of like traditional carbohydrates.
Right. Oh, you're right. Yeah.
What the sources are, but yeah,
right.
Fruits and vegetables are really the primary for a lot of them.
Right. You know, I will make a salad that has anywhere between 5 and 10 different fruits and vegetables, a couple of different greens. some strawberries, some blackberries, blueberries.
Yeah, the monster tomatoes. Last time we were in Virginia, I remember that.
Oh, yeah, so good. And then, you know, mushrooms, you know, so just a variety of and then I usually put a piece of salmon on top or some tuna.
Yeah, the goal there, as far as, you know, I think well-intentioned, that they focus a lot more on, you know, like, what is the best vegetable to have, or what is the best fruit to have? Well, fuck, are you having enough of it, number one?
Yeah.
Or are you having too much? Like, there's a balance component to it as well. Excessive fiber intake when you're not used to it, or even in times of high training or high stress, can cause your stomach to act a little funky. Sure. So it's managing the balance there. But really the focus is, are you having enough total volume, number one, kind of like energy? Do you have enough of a base? And then if you're not, then easy answer, fix it. Right. I don't want to go too far into the weeds if you don't have the baseline. And if you're, a lot of people say they don't like vegetables because all they've had is like grandma's steamed stuff that tastes like baby food with nothing on it. Right. So there's different ways to be able to do it to make it actually taste like something other than mush, or something that you would get in a nursing home, ultimately. Yeah. You know, you start on baby food, you end with baby food. But part of it too, you know, the goal is variety.
Right.
And not just variety because somebody upstairs told you to. Variety because each one of the colors that we see, you know, a lot of times people hear that kind of cheesy statement from dietitians, eat the rainbow. But all of those colors are comprised of what we call phytonutrients. They all have a very specific function. You know, people know about a lot of the vitamins and minerals, but they don't necessarily know that each one of those colors is comprised of things that actually have an intended purpose. And so the goal is to be able to have some variety. Just don't eat the same thing and only like green vegetables, for example. Right. It's great to have them.
Yes.
But don't only have that. Right?
You know, that's
have
a really
some
good,
variety in your life.
That's a really good point, because I remember at a conference that you and I attended that Jeff Nichols put on, you know, we were talking about the Tactical Optimal Performance conference, and I remember asking you a question about where are you getting all these carbs from, right? And you said grains. And I realized that I really don't do a lot of grains. I mean, I don't eat a lot of breads.
Yeah.
Just preference. It's not because I don't like bread. It's just something I don't do. I tend to eat more fruits and vegetables for my carbs. So after your conversation of telling me the importance of grains, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that, is I've gotten a little more creative with it. You know, from the rices, I've gone to quinoa and couscous, and you know,
there's unlimited amounts of options for sure.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and oats and you know things like that. So,
and I think that so again, kind of like the trying to stray away from the like typical line that people, they have a connotation of like, oh, you have to have grains. Why are you telling me I have to have grains? You don't have to. The issue that comes up is when you're managing the volume of intake that you have to put in and to be able to meet your energy demands, you're without causing yourself constant diarrhea or a lot of discomfort and constant fullness to a point where you can't put in enough. You're essentially displacing energy by having a ton of fiber. So it's about managing your fullness and energy availability at these different times by choosing a balance of these sources. You don't have to have one or the other. It's managing based on how much energy you need to either be in a deficit, be in a surplus, or stay neutral, making sure that having that fiber doesn't prevent you from having the energy just to complete your exercise. And if that does, then you're stepping over $100 bills to pick up pennies.
And you also don't want to be hungry all day.
Well, especially if you're in a deficit. If you're trying to lose weight, you're trying to lean out, you're going to be in some sort of a deficit.
Right.
Now, the amount that you're going to be in is a little bit different. So, you know, you're trying to manage your fullness throughout the day, like you said, that, and the ways to be able to do that is fat, fiber, and protein.
Yeah.
It's managing the amount that you have periodically. You're likely going to have more fiber than you do traditional carbohydrate sources. So when I say that, traditional grains or starchy vegetables, things like that. You're going to go more towards the non-starchy side and higher fiber options to be able to provide that kind of quote unquote artificial fullness. With it, right? And then potentially having slightly a little bit more fat and a little bit more consistent protein to match, because all those things together will provide you that level of fullness or satiety that keeps you from wanting to chew through the plate and the table that, that your food's on.
All right, let's talk about proteins. Do you have a particular preference, animal or plant protein, or good combination of both?
Put me in a spot that I can myself in a corner quick. No, I'm giving you a hard time. I prefer animal protein. There's not a problem with plant protein.
Sure.
I guess we go back to the argument of being able to get what we need and match our recovery needs overall. You're generally going to need, so there's a difference in bioavailability. So basically what your body can utilize, the amino acid profile is a little bit different in most plant sources compared to an animal source. And so what that usually demands, I guess, rule of thumb that you can generally follow across the board is if you're going to primarily have non-animal sources of protein as your main protein source, you need about 20% extra just to be able to meet that baseline need. So that's a considerable amount of volume.
That is a lot.
Added to it. So it's not saying that you can't do it. It just makes it a little bit harder.
Sure.
It takes a lot more diligence to be able to make sure that you're not eating away at the ability to recover those muscles, especially in high training volumes. And kind of those repeat efforts where you go on day in and day out or multiple times in a day, you're really challenging your body's ability to turn over. And so it's at what point do we tip to an area where recovery just can't catch up well enough because of our eating pattern? So I generally recommend that people, unless there's some sort of religious or other allergy issue where they can't, it's finding a way to be able to include good quality protein sources from mainly animal sources.
Sure.
And what that is, there's still a ton of different options.
So many options.
Yeah. And so it's just a matter of availability, price, all these things that go into the decisions that we make around food and training, et cetera. It's trying to fit. I get the other piece that goes a bit on the quote unquote touchy feely side, if I'm gonna call it that. You don't operate as an island a lot of times. You operate as part of a family unit going into it. And so if what you're doing is so far removed from your family and you can't make it work, and it forces you to kind of remove yourself from that, you know, being socially isolated can be just as harmful as some of these physical issues. And so it's allowing you to be able to maneuver what you're eating to have it be similar, let's say, for one meal a day to what your family's eating at dinner.
Yeah, sure.
That's what I found myself doing a lot of times, is like, okay, what's your wife going to make at home? Like, your stuff at the DFACS here, we got it. We're all squared away for the day. But when you go home and have dinner, you got three young kids or two young kids. You got a wife and a dog that's trying to scrape everything off the plate. What it's cooking and what can we get done? What adjustments do we need to make to yours? So it's not creating two different meals.
Right.
It's making sure that you can still function as a reasonable family and not have to add a ton of burden just to get this training done. So
that's a good point.
That's a consideration that a lot of people miss, is they create all these like wonderful, fancy, shiny things, like all the cool guy stuff for the high speed things. And they forget that like you have to function as a human being.
Yeah. The, you know, the protein sources are rich. I mean, you have eggs, you have chicken and fish and meats and, you know, dairy. You know, I personally like to mix.
Everybody's got their opinion.
Yeah, I personally like a mix of nuts and, you know, even the quinoa has a significant amount of protein in it. You know,
yeah.
You know, I mean, as a grain, you know, I'm looking on the back. I'm like, damn, it's got protein. You know, but you know, not compared to the same size of a piece of fish or something, but you know, it has something in it. So a good mix of all of those I have found to be the best answer for me.
And I think there's some pieces that I focus on a little bit. Let's say fish, for example. I think one of the things that, you know, people are constantly trying to manage inflammation. People are trying to get the best quality product that they're that they can. Obviously there's price involved with some of that. So a lot of times a very simple piece is if you're going to get salmon, wild caught, get farm raised. Part of it is, well, why? I'm going to have to pay a ton more. Well, you don't have to get fresh year round because their season is only a month long or 3.5 weeks. Yeah. So unless you want to pay $27 a pound,
you can find it
buy frozen.
Yeah.
You can get it at Costco for under $7 a pound, individually cryovacked in portions. But by getting that wild caught actually provides you that what people see as the benefit with salmon, that omega-3 benefit.
Sure.
You have the original feed source that provides you that benefit, whereas in farm salmon, they don't have that benefit. So if you think that you're getting that omega-3 benefit from the salmon, you better make sure that it's actually wild caught. The other piece as well is talking about food safety overall. There are some unique pieces in labeling laws, just like in manufacturing laws. Like if you put it together in the U.S., it can be a product in the U.S. So in the food side, there's a bit of a similar thing. So people talk about tilapia and some of the other white fishes that are farmed pretty rarely. They're not generally a problem, but the sourcing of them is really more of an issue. So if you look at the front of the package, it'll say product of the USA. Just flip it over to the back because they're required by law to be able to put the original source information of where that fish was farmed. So it may say product of the USA on the front. On the back, it may say farmed in China.
Oh, okay.
So it's just doing that double check, flip it over. A lot of the grocery stores have done a better job of separating them out. They're not kind of mixed in together, but it's just doing a quick check. It takes less than 5 seconds to look over. It's in a pretty decent sized font. It's not like the micro font with some of the others. Intentionally so that you can actually identify, and that really eliminates a lot of the potential for like heavy metal contamination and some of the other pieces that come with the process overall.
Nice. So while we're on the topic, what are the fats that we need primarily?
I mean, the fats that you need enough, like not to be a smart ass, but you need to have enough to be able to provide your body what you need to utilize and assimilate the fat-soluble vitamins. So A, D, and K, which are all, a lot of people pound vitamin D as far as being really, really important. There are others that are important as well. And if you don't have enough fat, then you have the potential to not be able to utilize what you need. Most people are in a relative deficiency anyway. So the minimum, so the RDA for most people, so it's the recommended daily allowance to prevent deficiencies, is 0.8 grams per kilo. So for somebody who's 220 pounds, it's about 80 grams a day.
Of
fat.
Minimum. Of fat. Okay. Gotcha.
If you go below that, you're actually doing yourself a disservice. So it's trying to make sure that you have enough. A lot of people ride the line pretty low. If you're eating out, you generally have a little bit more wiggle room because some of those, they added in quite a bit. But it's making sure that, can you have the butters, the bacons, things like that? Absolutely. You want to make your food palatable. Otherwise, you're not going to continue doing it.
Yeah.
But the more that you can include consistently, not in huge amounts, but in the appropriate amounts for the meals, avocado, nuts, seeds, that are providing you more of the omega-3 fatty acids, more of the mono and polyunsaturated fats to be able to help manage the inflammation as a whole. Inflammation is not by definition a bad thing, but you're managing the volume of work that you're doing and you're adding to the big picture overall by demanding so much exercise and recovery. It's trying to provide yourself the best opportunity to recover quickly and, not ask more of your body to turn things around.
Right. Because we always hear about the good fats, right? And the bad fats, but the bad fats taste really good.
And to be quite honest, the dose is a poison, if you want to call it that. Like it's really not that they're by definition bad. Most people just don't know how to moderate them.
Right.
People get pissed off when they hear everything in moderation, mainly because they don't have any gauge on themselves. It's not because that concept is wrong. It's that they can't moderate themselves.
Right.
I have kind of a category that I call like misses, right? So a lot of times people have this group of foods that they say are like absolutely unhealthy. There's no way I should be eating this. The reality is with a lot of high volume training, some of these foods are people have their opinions on high sugar, high fat, all these other things. Well, some of these foods, if they're a higher sugar food and you use them post-exercise, you can actually, you know, if you think about it, the mechanism of replenishing glycogen requires relatively simple carbohydrate
sure.
to make it happen faster. Can you use that to your advantage? It's about including it enough to prevent you from binging on it later, that pendulum swing, but also keeping it from getting in the way of your training and your goals, right? Are you doing something in a small amount consistently where you're not going to be like begging and pleading, you're waiting for that cheat day, you reward yourself after hitting all these goals with food and jack everything up again.
Right.
Instead of doing that, you can have things more frequently in considerably smaller amounts and not get in the way of your training. You continue down that path.
Nice. Yeah, everything. I love talking to dietitians and nutritionists because it just puts my mind at this nice little balance again. You know, because a lot of times you're right. You know, I mean, there's so much out there that are diametrically opposed to each other. You know, whether it's the vegetarian diet or it's the carnivore diet, you know, or the paleo diet or the what's another one? Whatever, you're eliminating carbs or you're eliminating fat.
Yeah. I first started a group, the prime example. So, you know, if the people that I listen are generally familiar with special operations population,
sure.
Pretty intense. They'll challenge you at every step and try to test you. So newly in the group, I think it was one of those moments of you're either going to float or you're gone. But I had a few of the experienced enlisted guys challenge me and say, you know, well, I do this paleo thing. I said, okay, cool. What's your version of that crap? And he started explaining. I said, okay, great. Good for you. It's like, I don't think anybody in their right mind would argue that if you have real food consistently in the right amounts, you have vegetables, fruit, carbohydrate, and protein in whatever form you can put in, that would be a bad thing.
Yeah.
Now you can call it something and all of a sudden it has a completely different meaning to everybody because of the name. Like, quit with the BS. Like, you're trying too hard. Like, I don't care what you call it. Eat what you need and not what you don't in certain instances, and making sure that, you know, if you have what you need to perform your job duties and to do your training, great. And if not, that's your fault.
Right.
And it's not only you in that instance, it's not only you that suffers. It's the other 11 or 12 guys. You're letting your team down. Not just you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, let's wrap this up here, Steve.
Yeah.
that's good. This has been really good. Thank you. So in the end, we have to eat to perform, right? We have to eat to recover from that performance and to also fuel ourselves for the next day of performance, right? That is a tricky balance. Then when you're in selection, you have to mysteriously find the fuel when the tank is empty. And that all comes down to your personal will and desire to actually finish this training. So there's some magic
involved.
You can't
physically turn that around. You have to figure out a way to get past that pain or embrace it.
Yeah. So there's magic involved.
Either the pain ends or you die. One way or the other, the suffering's over.
There you go. So any final words? Where can people find out more information about what you do? And I know you take clients, you know, to help them with individual programming.
The easiest place to find me, I mean, most people are on social media more than they probably should be, so Instagram is probably the easiest place to catch me if you're on there. It's at Fueling Performance, and if you're interested in some of those, you can feel free to send a message there, or my email is in my bio in there as well. So either way, send that over and we can figure out what works best. And thankfully, my website will be going live here.
Oh, that's right. You got a new website, fuelingperformance.us, correct?
Yep. Coming soon. I feel like that's been the mantra for a while. But
well, I will put those links into the description below so people can just click those and go right to you and ask you questions about nutrition, because I basically learn everything from other people about nutrition. And I say, well, here's what I do.
you're more humble than you probably should be in some ways. You've learned a lot more than, or well, you know more, you've forgotten more than most people have learned, to be quite honest.
But, well, I mean, but yeah, it's, but like I said, I'm not a dietitian. It's ever-changing. I'm not a nutritionist. And, yeah. You know, and I like to refer experts in their field, you know, to
type of
specific questions, especially when it comes down to, you know, creation of individualized programming, because you know, I can speak on it on a generic level, but you can take it down to the, you know, the ounces and the,
there's a lot of nuances and
minor details that are very important. So
yeah, it may not be the make or break, but it may be, you know, something that can break through some walls and really get the light bulb moment there for sure. But yeah, I appreciate you taking the time for having me on. I know everybody's busy, so.
Hey, thank you very much, Steve. Once again, everybody check him out, fuelingperformance.us, and on Instagram, Fueling Performance. So thanks again, Steve.
Thank you.
All right, we'll see you later. All right, all done recording.
Cool. Well, thanks again, man. I really appreciate it.